It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday News. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It's your public radio station. Broadcasting from atop Signal Hill here in Kodiak, Alaska, where it's 28 degrees, kind of crusty out there. Slippery conditions on the roads. We're looking for a slight chance of snow showers before 3 p.m. today, then a slight chance of rain and snow showers after that. Mostly cloudy skies tonight with a high near 37, or this afternoon. Southeast wind to 15 miles per hour will turn to the northwest this afternoon. For tonight, slight chance of rain before 9 p.m., then rain and snow showers likely. Cloudy skies overnight with a low around 34. Northwest wind to 20 miles per hour will turn to the east tonight and go to 20 miles per hour after midnight. New snow accumulation of less than a half an inch is possible tonight. Coming up, active cases continue to go down in the Kodiak area.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. On the eve of an election that determines a balance of power in the U.S. Senate, Georgia's top elections officials are imploring voters not to listen to the swell of disinformation and conspiracy theories President Trump's supporters have been peddling on behalf of an incumbent who refuses to accept that he lost Georgia. Moments ago, Gabriel Sterling, the voting system implementation manager in Georgia, addressed in detail and in tones of exasperation every charge Trump's legal team has made in disputing the legitimacy of the election in Georgia. He essentially said that nothing the president has alleged is accurate and told Georgians to vote.
Do not let anybody discourage you. Do not self-suppress your own vote. Do not make a self-fulfilling prophecy out of doing this. Don't let anybody steal your vote that way.
Earlier today, Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger released a recording of a phone call he got from President Trump Saturday in which Trump is heard telling Raffensperger to find votes to overturn the election results. Florida's Republican governor says complaints that rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine is going too slowly are unfair. NPR's Greg Allen reports Florida is beginning to make the vaccine available to everyone 65 and older.
The first vaccine doses in Florida were reserved for frontline healthcare workers and residents of long-term care facilities. But Florida Governor Ron DeSantis says now the vaccine will be made available to the more than 4 million people in the state, 65 and older.
This is based on data. And if you look at the COVID mortality, 65 and up represents over 80% of the COVID-related mortality.
Counties that have already started vaccinating seniors are struggling with an overwhelming demand. In Daytona Beach, cars began lining up overnight Monday at a vaccination site that reached capacity before 7 a.m. Governor DeSantis blames the slow start on the holidays and says he expects the number of people being vaccinated to rise quickly. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Stocks have closed down sharply. The Dow is down 382 points, or 1.25%, at 30,223. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
The first day of trading in the new year was a rocky one for the stock market. All the major indexes lost ground after finishing out 2020 at or near record highs. Investors are counting on new vaccines to overcome the economic losses associated with the coronavirus pandemic, but initial distribution of the shots in the United States has been slower than expected, and there are fears the country's already sky-high infection rate could climb even higher after many Americans ignored warnings to avoid travel during the holidays. Markets are also keeping an eye on Tuesday's runoff elections in Georgia, which will determine whether Republicans or Democrats have the upper hand in the U.S. Senate. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
Kodiak Island was shaken by a minor earthquake over the weekend, just 57 miles from Kodiak, according to the Alaska Earthquake Center. The 4.7 magnitude quake occurred late Saturday night at 11:45 p.m. in the middle of Uyak Bay at a depth of about 60 kilometers. The quake did not trigger a tsunami warning for Kodiak Island, but was felt by some residents. The Kodiak Area Emergency Services Organization has announced 9 new COVID-19 cases for the Kodiak Island borough. Among these were 6 close contact cases, 2 community transmission cases, and 1 travel-related case. This brings the total case count to 921 cases in the Kodiak Island borough since the start of the pandemic, with 41 cases classified as active locally. There have been 37 hospitalizations to date, with 1 patient currently hospitalized, and there have been 5 deaths due to COVID-19 locally since the start of the pandemic. You may know it as the COVID relief bill that sent you $600. It's also the bill President Trump finally signed to avoid a government shutdown. Less known as the massive year-end bill is the most significant law to fight climate change that Congress has passed in years and maybe ever. Alaska Public Media correspondent Liz Ruskin has this report.
The energy section of this 5,000-page bill is labeled Division Z, and it's its own kind of huge. Senator Lisa Murkowski has been working on it for years.
Well, remember that energy bill that we had on the floor back in February and then in early March?
Murkowski couldn't pass it then, but as chair of the Energy Committee, she negotiated for months behind the scenes, adding energy priorities along the way. It all came together in the waning days of 2020, and it hopped the last train leaving the congressional station, the COVID/government spending bill. Division Z has a smorgasbord of energy programs, old and new.
It's historic. It's certainly the largest clean energy and climate bill in a decade.
Rich Powell leads ClearPath, a group advocating for conservative solutions to climate change. Some 70 senators and House members contributed to the energy part of the bill. Powell says key features came from Murkowski's committee.
The piece that we're most excited about is the huge moonshot program to develop new innovative clean energy technologies.
The bill has billions to research and develop wind, solar, hydro, and geothermal, plus energy storage to make renewables more useful. It aims to develop new kinds of nuclear power. The bill will establish 20 major demonstration projects over the next 5 years. Powell says it will combat climate change by acting as a launch pad for new technologies.
And we need them fast. We need to develop them in the mid-2020s so that companies in the United States can deploy them in the 2030s and bring the cost down, and then the rest of the world can deploy them in the 2040s.
LG Holstein of the Environmental Defense Fund says it's also important that the bill continues tax credits for existing technology like wind and solar energy, plus a new credit for offshore wind.
Those tax credits have been critical in helping to bring down the cost, and those costs are still falling, for these clean energy sources.
Some of the bill's provisions have particular relevance in Alaska. It expands the weatherization assistance program to help retrofit homes. It also encourages the development of hybrid microgrid systems for isolated communities. The bill doesn't go as far as some climate groups wanted. Critics say there's not enough support for electric vehicles or smart buildings, nor does it cap greenhouse gas emissions, though it does phase out an especially potent kind, HFCs or hydrofluorocarbons. Some environmental groups don't like that the bill has programs for capturing carbon dioxide to keep the greenhouse gas out of the atmosphere. They say it props up the fossil fuel industry. And the bill divides the fossil fuel lobby. The American Petroleum Institute praises the carbon capture programs, while the American Energy Alliance complains it is a stealth Green New Deal with giveaways for the renewable power industry. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska Congressman Don Young administered the oath of office to Nancy Pelosi on Sunday after she won the vote for another term as Speaker of the House.
Madam Speaker, before I issue the oath, I'd like to take privilege of the floor as the dean.
Swearing in the speaker is one official duty of the dean, the longest-serving House member. Young seized the moment to make an unexpected call for cooperation and civility.
I've been in this house longer than anybody else. I've served with you longer than anybody else has served with you. I love this institution. I will be honest, I do not like what I see. It's time we hold hands and talk to one another.
That statement drew a standing ovation. He went on to remind Pelosi that she will be the Speaker of the entire House, not of her party.
And I say this with all sincerity, Madam Speaker, that when you do have a problem or if there's something so contentious, let's sit down and have a drink. And solve those problems for the good of this nation.
Pelosi thanked him. She said she doesn't drink but would be happy to discuss matters over ice cream. President Trump's false claim that he won the 2020 election has divided Republicans in the U.S. Senate into three camps. Senator Lisa Murkowski is among those who say they'll affirm Joe Biden's win when Congress counts the Electoral College votes on Wednesday. She issued two official statements to that effect over the weekend. Saturday, she said judges and state legislatures, quote, have honored their duty to hear legal allegations and have found nothing to warrant overturning the results, unquote. Sunday, Murkowski joined senators of both parties to say the voters have spoken and all legal challenges have failed. To quote the bipartisan statement, at this point, further attempts to cast doubt on the legitimacy of the 2020 presidential election are contrary to the clearly expressed will of the American people. Murkowski is among 19 Republicans in that camp, according to the Washington Post tally this morning. So far, a dozen senators are heeding Trump's call to fight the election results. Alaska's Senator Dan Sullivan is among 20 Republican senators who haven't declared themselves with or against the Trump loyalists. Sullivan acknowledged Biden as the president-elect in mid-December. He hasn't proclaimed a position since Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri kicked off the opposition last week, ensuring the Senate will debate the Electoral College results. Within Alaska's criminal justice system, the poor and vulnerable have experienced the greatest impact from the COVID-19 pandemic. KNOM's Colin O'Connor reports on what those in the court system are saying about those affected.
Indigent and marginalized populations are some of the hardest hit by the pandemic and the socioeconomic consequences of the pandemic.
That's Benjamin Muse, deputy director at the Alaska Public Defender Agency. He believes some of their clients have taken the brunt of the hardships dealt by the pandemic. The Alaska Public Defender Agency serves the public to provide legal representation to poverty-stricken clients who cannot afford an attorney. Muse notes that their work has been challenging in this unusual time. Even the Alaska court system did not have any fine-tuned plan to operate within the COVID pandemic, according to Chief Justice Joel Bolger.
We had a broad continuation of operations plan. And it included things like earthquakes and also included things like pandemics. But the plan did not envision a pandemic that was as severe and deadly as this pandemic.
Bolger and the presiding judges of the four judicial districts in Alaska meet weekly to discuss concerns and where action needs to be made. He believes that people's rights are being maintained to the best extent possible, consistently with the safety of everyone involved. The court and the Alaska Department of Corrections, DOC, has had to make adjustments in an effort to balance maintaining the judicial process and protecting the community from the transmission of the virus. Muse points out, this is where maintaining someone's rights to a fair and just process, like bail and speedy trial, can be overlooked.
There's kind of a desire in a situation like this to try to streamline things, you make things as efficient as possible, and we are working to make sure that our clients aren't neglected, that their rights are attended to during this time.
Muse says the pressure to reduce any backlog within the system means that new procedures must be implemented. Again, holding telephonic court hearings, suspending jury trials, and restricting visitation for those incarcerated. Muse also recognizes a unique challenge brought on by suspended jury trials.
We're dealing with clients who Some of them can't make bail and are languishing in prison without any end inside of their case because they can't. They can't take their case to trial and be exonerated or bring finality to the legal proceedings that have been brought against them. You know, it's some of them are getting pretty desperate because we're going on a year come March with no jury trial.
Without the specter of trial looming on the horizon, Hughes says, defense and prosecution are less likely to feel pressured to resolve a case. In a pre-pandemic setting, the legal parties would discuss a case and attempt to agree on a resolution based on the facts of the case. And when they can't come to an agreement, they move forward with trial proceedings. But with trials on hold, Hughes says the defense and prosecution alike have no time constraints forcing them to delve deeper into the details of a case. District Attorney in Nome John Earthman agrees that cases are not reaching resolutions as they would pre-pandemic.
The trial and the clock does keep things moving, and the pressure of a trial does create resolutions. And not having that does defer resolutions.
This has left many people in a state of limbo. Being in limbo is something that many people can relate to during this time, but the effects are magnified while incarcerated. The Alaska DOC ended in-person visitation at the start of the pandemic. This not only limited the way which an incarcerated person has contact with their counsel, but also their friends and family. Muse says it has also posed a challenge for public defenders working to build a trusting relationship with their clients and being effective legal counsel. Moreover, it is having impact on clients' sense of hope.
Our clients are feeling very isolated. And as anybody can imagine who can imagine, if you're charged with a crime and you're maybe at the lowest point in your life and you're in custody, you probably want to speak with somebody. You want to speak with your attorney or your family members. So it's made things very difficult, and it's been very hard on our clients.
The lack of quality communication in this time of stress creates the hopelessness. Across the state, in-person grand jury trial proceedings are suspended at least until February 1st, 2021, and in-person jury trial proceedings are suspended until at least March 15th, 2021. Reporting in Nome, I'm Colin O'Connor.
With the first ever oil lease sale in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge just 2 days away, a federal judge here in Alaska will consider a request today to stop the Trump administration from issuing the oil leases. U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason will hear the oral arguments by video conference at 1 p.m. in a case brought by the National Audubon Society and three other environmental groups. The groups argued in a lawsuit filed in August that the federal government failed to follow numerous laws meant to protect wildlife, land, water, and people when it crafted its oil leasing program for the Arctic Refuge. The administration is now set to open bids Wednesday in the first ever lease sale in the refuge. But whether the oil leases actually go to the highest bidders could be up to Gleason. The environmental groups are asking her to block the government from issuing the leases until the broader lawsuit is resolved. The groups say the Trump administration is rushing to lock in oil drilling in the refuge in the president's final weeks. The government has defended its process, saying it's following the law. Each side will have 20 minutes today to argue their points in federal court. Around Christmas, there were reports of an earthquake and a major mountain rock slide in the wilderness near Juneau. But which came first, the earthquake or the slide? KTOO's Matt Miller tried to find out.
Jamie Tate is a helicopter pilot based out of British Columbia. The day after Christmas, he and his family were flying along the Taku River Valley after checking on a cabin in the area.
Well, it's pretty interesting because I've flown down that river for probably the better part of 35 years. I mean, I noticed it right away before the rest of my family did, and it's pretty significant.
One mountain along the river, about 46 miles northeast of Juneau, looked like part of its face had been sliced off.
The area in the valley was all full of the debris and mud that had been pushed up when the mountainside collapsed.
Sonia Nagorski, assistant professor of geology at the University of Alaska Southeast, says some of that area's mountain slopes are over 50 degrees, or the slopes are so steep that they're almost like a cliff face.
And so it just crumbles and fails. It's pretty astounding that those rocks are sitting at this steep angle at all.
Nagorski says there's a lot of volcanic rock that used to be under the Earth's surface. It's not as strong as other forms of rock, and it's more susceptible to weathering like rain, snow, and ice, combined with a lot of freezing and thawing.
It's easy to think that our mountains are solid and stable, but the Earth's surface is constantly shifting, especially when there are tectonic changes and glacial changes. A lot of changes can be quite sudden, and landsliding is the primary method of erosion in mountains steeper than about 30 to 40 degrees, which are plentiful here.
Nagorski says it's not clear exactly how much of the nearly 4,000-foot mountain actually flaked off and fell away on Christmas Eve. Her best estimate is 20 million cubic feet of material. That's enough to fill up half of the Houston Astrodome. When all that rock fell, it was literally enough to shake the Earth. Natalia Rupert, a seismologist with the Alaska Earthquake Center, says if the shaking was caused by an earthquake, then it would have registered as a magnitude 2.8 or 2.9. Rupert is clear, however, the landslide itself was not triggered by any previous earthquake. She knows that because it's very easy for seismologists to distinguish a sudden, abrupt start of an earthquake from a landslide's gradual building intensity, sometimes over several minutes.
It starts very small, and then gradually the amplitude of the signal picks up, and it becomes larger and larger as the landslide mass kind of gains momentum and moves down the slope. And then it fades out as all those rocks come to a final resting place.
The Taku River is one of the biggest salmon-producing rivers in southeast Alaska. Since it crosses an international boundary, both United States and Canada share the harvest. David Harris, commercial fisheries area management biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, says the slide likely destroyed any salmon row at the foot of the mountain, but he believes it won't have a big impact on salmon runs overall.
The channel's fairly braided. There's two or three large channels already, plus smaller connecting side sloughs and whatnot. There's plenty of room for the water to find a way through. It's not like a narrow valley that's filled up with material.
Harris says much bigger landslides completely block the Taku and other places, but the river always finds a way to cut right through them. Pilot Jamie Tate warns Alaskans who have cabins or recreate along the Taku to watch out for lots of uprooted and dead trees to wash downriver in the spring. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
KMXT Local News is underwritten in part by
GCI. GCI has adjusted store hours across the state to keep our customers and employees as safe as possible during this time. The most up-to-date store hours are available on GCI.com.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Alaska's salmon are smaller. How might that affect markets? More after this.
Seafood Auction says thanks to longline fishermen and seafood buyers for a successful 2020 season and looks forward to working together again in 2021. Learn more at seafoodauction.net.
Since 2010, Alaska salmon have been getting smaller. That conclusion is based on 60 years of measurements from 12.5 million salmon across Alaska, excluding pinks. A study by Nature Communications has compared average body lengths before 1990 and after 2010. Chinook salmon have shown the most size reduction, averaging an 8% decline, compared to 3.3% in cohos, 2.4% in chum salmon, and a 2.1% shrinkage in sockeyes. Researchers speculate that rising water temperatures in lakes and streams have prompted salmon to head out to sea far sooner than normal. The drop in time spent in freshwater slows down fish maturity, increases time at sea, and the salmon return at younger ages to spawn. Smaller fish produce lower yields. Tasha Cadence is with Tradex, a global seafood trading company based in Canada.
Anyone who smokes their salmon has a very specific recipe guideline in order to produce a consistent product. Therefore, if they typically were to use a 4 to 6-pound sockeye and the catch is heavy on the 2 to 4-pound sockeye, they have to retool the whole operation.
The smaller size also hurts processors who sell fish portions.
These changes in processing could directly affect companies who make prepackaged and portioned flavored retail items for freezers.
The smaller salmon could affect short-term values, but that could be offset by a big decline in global harvests of sockeye pinks and chums this year. In the longer term, TradeX predicts that a shortage of wild salmon inventories will lead to pricing gains as buyers, quote, lean towards the demand for smaller salmon. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon, and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the fourth day of January, the year 2021. Sun rose today at 9:52. It won't set again until 4:39 this afternoon, giving us a total of 6 hours and 47 minutes of precious daylight hours. That is a gain of 2 minutes and 4 seconds compared to yesterday. And Willie, who writes these out, a nice little cheat sheet for us, he circled gain, he crossed out loss, he put a plus sign and an up arrow, indicating that indeed we are gaining time at a rate of 2 minutes plus per day. Looking at our local tides, we have a high tide coming up here on the east side at 5:09 p.m. That will be a 7.99-foot tide. Let's call it an 8-foot tide. Followed by a low tide at 11:53 p.m. That will be a 0.13-foot tide. Our next high tide will be at 6:25 tomorrow morning of 7.8 feet. And their low tide tomorrow afternoon will be at 12:19 p.m. of 2.54 feet here on the east side. Over on the west side, and these are Uganic Pass tides, you have a high tide coming up at 5:47 this afternoon of 13.53 feet, followed by a low tide at 12:19 a.m., just after midnight, of 0.68 feet. Your next high tide will be at tomorrow morning at 6:45 a.m. of 14.02 feet, and your low tide for tomorrow afternoon on the west side will be at 12:59 p.m., 1 p.m., 3.48 feet. 29 degrees here in Kodiak right now. Slight chance of snow before 3, then slight chance of rain and snow after that. Mostly cloudy skies overnight with a high near 37. East wind 5 miles per hour turn to the northwest. For tomorrow, we're looking for showers. High near 39. Northeast wind to 25. Chance of precipitation 80% tomorrow. And rain showers tomorrow night before 3 a.m., then rain and snow showers after that, a low around 35. North wind to 20, will turn to the northwest after midnight tomorrow night. Mariners, here is your synopsis for the North Gulf Coast, including Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet. A 968 millibar low over the North Pacific will move to 50 nautical miles southwest of Port Alexander and go to 972 millibars by Monday afternoon, before moving inland. Another 957 millibar low, 240 nautical miles southwest of Port Alexander, will move on Tuesday morning to 190 nautical miles south of Middleton Island and go to 956 millibars Tuesday night and absorb a North Pacific low to the south. All that action means a small craft advisory through Tuesday. Marmot Island to Sitkanat, Kodiak's east side offshore. Variable 10 right now, seas to 8 feet. For tomorrow, look for east winds to 25 knots and seas to 14 feet. Tuesday night, north 25, seas to 14 feet. And for Wednesday, south winds to 25 knots, seas to 16 feet on the east side for Wednesday. Over on the west side in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory tonight and Tuesday. East wind 20 knots right now and seas to 5 feet. For tomorrow, look for northeast wind to 30 knots, seas to 12 feet. And for Tuesday night, north winds to 25 knots, seas to 10 feet. Wednesday in the Shelikof, northeast 25, seas to 9 feet. Well, if you're looking at your Christmas tree right now and wondering if it's about to spontaneously combust, you can just cart it down to the former library site right in the middle of town for Christmas tree recycling. And I think you just go drop it off. But remember, they won't take artificial trees, and they also won't take trees who have been flocked. And keep your wreaths for next year. Some Kodiak meetings coming up for the Kodiak Island Borough, and these meetings are all virtual. To find out how to attend and participate, go to the Kodiak Island Borough website. Also, the assembly regular meetings are always broadcast here on KMXT on 100.1 FM. The Solid Waste Contract Subcommittee is having a meeting tonight. Oh, no, they had that at 9 a.m. this morning, sorry. The assembly will be having a work session tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. The Solid Waste Advisory Board will be meeting on Wednesday at 5:15 p.m. The assembly will be having its regular meeting Thursday at 6:30 p.m. And the Consolidation Committee is scheduled to meet Monday at 6:30 p.m. Again, all these meetings are available online. Look to the Kodiak Island Borough website for more details. The Kodiak Archipelago Cooperative Weed Management meeting is happening on the 26th of January. It's not what it sounds. It's a partnership between different entities and landowners to manage invasive plants on the islands of Kodiak. That's happening Tuesday, the 26th, from 1:30 to 2:30 via Zoom. For more information and to get the Zoom link, go to danielle.butts@kodiaksoilandwater.org.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT two times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.